I suppose one of the most difficult chapters in the book of Numbers, at least difficult for our sentiments, would be chapter 31, the chapter we come to now. It is a war, and there are many wars in the Bible, but it is one of those wars that is particularly difficult for us because it is so much a holy war. It is a war of extermination. And many of us, especially those of us who've had the luxury of living in a land of peace all of our lives, and for whom war has never really been a reality except something we read about or see on television taking place on another part of the world, and which we can forget about most of the time, we have had that luxury. Just the very thought of war at all is unsavory. But we do understand that some wars have been seemingly justifiable. We usually think of the war that was conducted by our fathers against the Nazis in World War II. We consider that must have been a justifiable war. Hitler was such a monster, and he had to be stopped. But, of course, modern wars are conducted, at least from our side, with a mind of trying to observe certain moral principles, especially the desire, as much as possible, to preserve the immunity of non-combatants, so that it makes it a little more palatable for us to say, well, we had to go to war, we had to fight. Sure, a lot of people were killed, but, hey, war is hell. But these wars of extermination are harder for us because even, women and children are killed deliberately, not by accident. And it just doesn't seem to us like anything that is moral. But there are things that we need to remember. And one of them is that God is the one who has put the death sentence on every man and every woman and every child. Every child that dies in war would die some other way if not in war. Maybe not that year. Maybe not that decade. But they would die. Death is the one thing that equalizes all human experience. And that's what Solomon observed in Ecclesiastes. You know, one thing happens to everybody, the rich and the poor, the wise and the foolish. Doesn't matter what you are in life, you always reach the end of it. And then you die. Some people die in infancy. Some die as old people. But it's really no more advantage to die as an old person than as an infant if you die old and unprepared for death. You see, ultimately what matters is what happens after you die. That's where things are not the same for everybody. Everybody dies. If there's an airline crash and everybody on the plane dies, there's good people and bad people, old people and young people. There's just wholesale death. And we think, oh, what a tragedy that is. But it's not an unheard of tragedy. It happens all the time. And some might say, well, how would God allow something like that to happen? Why would God allow there to be a tsunami or something like that that wipes out men, women, and children? Well, God doesn't always explain to us why He allows a particular disaster to occur and people to die. But we do have an answer in general of why all these people die and why we die. Why we will die and everyone loved by us will die. It's because people die. Because of sin. The wages of sin is death. We're all sinners. We'll all die. If we die in infancy, if we die at age 95, it doesn't make much difference after that. After we've died, what makes a difference is whether we were prepared to meet God or not. And a lifetime of 95 years, as opposed to 95 seconds or 95 minutes after birth, that difference is less than a century's difference. And in eternity, a century is like a blip. Once you have gone into eternity, it won't matter to you how long your lifetime had been. You will have no regrets about having died young or old. You'll only have regrets about dying unprepared. And we need to, from a Christian point of view, keep that in perspective. We are so worldly minded that we think it's a great tragedy for a child to die. Well, it is a tragedy for the parents, if they happen to survive to grieve. It's a great tragedy for a child to die. It's a great tragedy for anyone to die. For an old man to die is a tragedy. Death is a tragedy. This has come upon us all. But it may not be as much of a tragedy for a child to die as for an old sinner to die unrepentant, especially if God has a special place in his heart for infants and children. As Jesus said, of such is the kingdom of heaven. That is to say, if children are already, as it were, prepared to meet God because they are small, because they are young, because they're innocent. If that is the case, now not all theologians would agree with that. I think the Bible does teach that. I think Jesus taught that. But not all theologians would agree with that. But if it is true, then the only tragedy about the child's death is the same tragedy about anyone's death at any time. That death is a tragedy. Jesus wept at the tomb of Lazarus because death is tragic. But he also raised Lazarus from the dead. And he will raise all people from the dead. And some will be raised to a resurrection of life, and some to a resurrection of condemnation. Children who die, I believe, will be raised to a resurrection of life. Those same children, had they not died and grown up, might have ended up worshiping idols like their parents did, the Midianites and the Canaanites and so forth, and then died, much less prepared to meet God than they actually were when they died as infants. From God's point of view, now see, everything I've just said might sound like a neat rationalization for the unthinkable. Genocide is unthinkable. Well, it's not unthinkable if it's God's declaration, because you will die, and you will die exactly how God decides you will die. You will die because it is the sentence that is upon us all. If you die young or old, it'll be God's decision. Children die, sadly, of cancer. They die of accidents. They die in criminal situations. They die in war all the time. It's sad. It's mostly sad, though, for their parents and for the survivors. Because after the child dies, if they are in fact in the presence of God, they have no regrets that they died at that time instead of dying later in their life. Same is true of people dying at any age. Now, in this story, we read of the dispatching of children and women, two categories that we have historically in the Western civilization sought to make immune to the horrors of war. Of course, now we have women in combat. Just in my lifetime, that has begun. But through most of history, women were not in combat, nor children certainly, and therefore the ethics of a Christian society have always sought to preserve and protect the immunity of non-combatants, which would include women and children. However, in a holy war like this, God is deciding that a whole civilization is to be wiped out, essentially. And it is specifically going to be a judgment upon the actions of the women of that society. These people were not killed because they were combatants. These people were killed because God had the death sentence upon them, and this was their time to go. This is a judgment of God on their society. It was no more or less so than when God sent fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah. Men, women, and children died there too. Or the flood of Noah's day. Men, women, and children died in that as well. In fact, if there had been no fire and brimstone upon Sodom and Gomorrah, if there had been no flood of Noah, and had there been no invasion of the Israelites against the Midianites in chapter 31 of Numbers, all those people would have died by now anyway and would have been facing their eternal fate the same as the way things really did happen. Because men, women, and children are all going to die. That God may decide it's time for these men, women, and children to die now is God's prerogative. It makes it more difficult when he says, and they're going to die at the tip of the swords of the Israelites. Because if we try to picture it, that means we're looking at Israelites actually stabbing and killing women and children. We can barely imagine. We can barely endure the mental picture of that. And by the way, sometimes people say that these wars of Israel were like the jihad of Islam. And they say, why do you Christians criticize the jihad when you don't criticize Moses and the people of Israel. It's not the same at all. Not even close. For one thing, the question has got to be raised whether the God of Islam has as much claim to be believed as the real God as the God of Moses or not. Because clearly, the real God has the right to decide when anyone dies. Especially if everyone deserves to die. If we're all born sinners, we all deserve to die, then God doesn't have to justify his action in taking anyone at any time. Every breath we take from the moment we're born until the time we die is a breath that's given us by the grace of God, something undeserved by us. It's not necessary for God to justify himself saying, okay, it's your time, it's his time, it's their time, it's her time. That's God's choice. People who worship and know the true God know that's true. Islam worships a false God. And a God who has not given any evidence of being the true God. Whereas the God of Moses gave evidence every time people turned around of being the true God. But more than that, the wars that Yahweh commanded Israel to conduct are not even in principle similar to the wars of Allah. Because Allah, in the Quran, requires people to be converted to Islam or die. Now, that's not the way modern Muslims, except for the radical ones, usually represent the teaching of the Quran, but that's how Muhammad understood it. That's how Mecca became a Muslim city, because Muhammad and his soldiers went and invaded and made everyone convert at the tip of the sword, and then they continued out from there and did the rest of the Arab world. Modern westernized Arabs, westernized Muslims, we might even say Christianized Muslims in the modern world, they may represent the nature of the jihad differently than that, but I think Muhammad himself understood it quite well. After all, he's the one who gave us the Quran, and he certainly believed in forcing people to convert or die. There's no parallels to that in the wars of the Jews. They didn't make anyone convert. They didn't even give them the choice to convert. This was simply judgment. And it was only on a few societies. Unlike Islam that wants to force the whole world to convert to Islam or perish, Yahweh wasn't trying to convert the Midianites or the Canaanites. They were simply a society whose time had run its course. Their wickedness was so great it was time for them to be eliminated, like Sodom and Gomorrah. It's just going to be by swords rather than fire from heaven in this case. And therefore, God has every justification for what he did. And it's not like he's saying convert or die. It's just die. The amazing thing is that even though God had issued the death sentence on these societies, he even allowed them to convert if they would. He didn't invite them to. But Rahab, for example, was a Canaanite who would have died, but she and her whole family were saved because they did, without an invitation from God, they did decide to side with God, and he spared them. So we're not talking here about wars of converting societies and threatening people, you convert to our religion or die. The Jews weren't even interested in converting people to their religion. They just wanted to be isolated to themselves. They wanted to have their own land. And this is what God had set for them to acquire. And it just so happened that the land he was giving them was land that was inhabited by people that God was sick of and whose behavior had been so repulsive to him, he had already decided it's time for them to be eliminated. It was just convenient that the Israelites were there to be the source of that judgment. And so this is how we have to view, I think, the wars of Canaan and the war against Midian in this case. Now, the Midianites were not Canaanites. The Midianites, in fact, were related to Israel somewhat, not very closely. The Midianites had descended from Abraham, but not through Isaac or Ishmael. They had descended from Abraham through Midian, who was one of the children of Abraham by Keturah. But in that sense, they were as closely related to Israel as, in fact, more closely related to Israel than Moab and Ammon, nations that God would not allow Israel to attack because of their close relationship, and Edom. But the Midianites, though they were, in fact, a sort of a brother nation, they were very unbrotherly. And we know that in chapter 25 of Numbers, the Midianites and the Moabites as a coalition had had made a scheme against Israel and had sent their women in among the Israelites to seduce them sexually and to draw them into the worship of their Midianite / Moabite gods, because the pagan gods were worshipped through sexual rites in those days. We don't have any major religions of the world now that venerate prostitution as a priestly function of priestesses in modern religions. But the ancient religions, especially of the Middle East, and even later of the Greeks, did have temple prostitutes. They were the priestesses. They used sexual lust as a means of drawing people into the worship of their gods. Now, in the case of Numbers chapter 25, when the Moabite and Midianite women came and seduced them in Israel, it wasn't just because they wanted to have a party. It wasn't just because they wanted to have a good time or they just wanted to have sex. This was drawing them into the worship of Chemosh or some other Moabite god. It doesn't name which god, but the Moabites did worship Chemosh. And therefore, the Israelites were brought into not just sexual immorality, but a sexual immorality that was associated with the worship of a false god. It was actually an attempt, apparently, to institute in the tabernacle itself cult prostitution. And that's what was going on when, in chapter 25, we read that Zimri, the son of Salu, took Cosby, the daughter of Zur, into the tent, the tabernacle, and started having sex with her there. And Phinehas, the son of the high priest, ran in and shoved a javelin through both of them and pinned them like butterflies to a card. And that stopped a plague of sorts that had taken out 24,000 of the Jews of Israel because God was so angry at them. But he wasn't done with Midian, because in chapter 25 and verse 17, God said to Moses, harass the Midianites and attack them, because they harassed you with their schemes by which they seduced you in the matter of Peor, in the matter of Cosby, the daughter of the leader of Midian, a leader of Midian, their sister. Now that's chapter 25, verses 17 and 18. We come now to the place in chapter 31 where they begin to obey that command of God to harass Midian. And it is going to be an amazing war. As far as we know, it's the only war Israel fought against an overwhelmingly large force, and Israel did not lose one soldier. Usually, in the wars even of Canaan, the Israelites lost a few men. But in this war, they sent only 12,000 soldiers against an overwhelmingly larger force, at least 100,000 Midianites. The Midianites outnumbered the Israelites at least 10 to 1. How do we know that? Because after they'd killed all the males and all the women who were not virgins, there were still 32,000 virgin women. Certainly, they would make up only a small portion of the whole population. Certainly, that would make the total population of the Midianites more than 100,000. And yet, Israel sends out only 12,000? Soldiers, and they don't lose one. It's an incredible victory. But that's because God was in it. God was judging the Midianites. He was not on this occasion judging Israel. He did judge Israel when Israel deserved it on occasions, but this time he's not judging them, he's judging the Midianites. So they had an incredible victory over overwhelming opposition. Now, chapter 31 then begins, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take vengeance for the children of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people. As Moses is going to die, this is the last thing he's going to lead Israel in, is this vengeance upon the Midianite people for what had happened at Baal Peor. And then Moses is told he's going to die. So Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm some of yourselves for the war, and let them go against the Midianites to take vengeance for the Lord on Midian. Now, God had said that they're going to take vengeance for Israel in verse 2. Take vengeance for the children of Israel on the Midianites. But Moses was not wrong to say that they were taking vengeance against the Midianites for the Lord, because it was the Lord whose people Israel was, and who had been offended by what Israel had done with the Midianites. Now, remember that Israel had already experienced their judgment for this. 24,000 of the Israelites had been slain in a plague. And that was after the leaders of the Baal-Peor incident had been hung. And then Zimri was speared along with his mistress, his prostitute more like. And so Israel had already sustained their judgment for that incident. Now the Midianites were going to experience theirs. Israel had not provoked Midian. Israel had not provoked Moab. And yet Moab and Midian had done this thing to corrupt and to destroy Israel. And therefore, those societies, that was the last mistake they were going to make. Verse 4, 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war. So there were recruited from the divisions of Israel 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. Then Moses sent them to war, 1,000 from each tribe. In case you missed that, the first two times they said that. He sent them to war with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, with holy articles and the signal trumpets in his hand. Now, the holy articles usually is a term that's used for the furniture of the tabernacle. Scholars are not fully agreed as to whether all the furniture went out or whether the holy articles refers to something like the Urim and the Thummim. But the Urim and the Thummim probably would not go out because Eleazar, the high priest who had them, didn't go out. Phinehas, his son, led the armies. Now, the priests did not usually lead the armies. Phinehas was not going out there as a general or a commander or a fighter. Phinehas was going out there as a representative of God, more as an inspiration to the troops, that God's priest was among them. Priests usually didn't go to war. And in this case, it's not even likely that Phinehas did any fighting. He was at the head of the procession of the holy articles. The holy articles almost certainly would have included the Ark of the Covenant, possibly the other furniture of the tabernacle too. Some feel that the silver trumpets that are mentioned there, the signal trumpets, are what is referred to as the holy articles, and that that's all that they took with them. But it seems to me most likely from the wording that they took the Ark of the Covenant and some of the other items from the tabernacle, which we know was done, because it's stated more explicitly, at a later time in the book of 1 Samuel, centuries later, when Israel went out against the Philistines. And actually the Philistines captured the Ark on that occasion. But on this occasion, God was with Israel. And they warred against the Midianites, just as the Lord commanded Moses. And they killed all the males. That would be all the male adults. The male children were not yet killed. They killed the kings of Midian, and the rest of those who were killed, namely Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian. Balaam, the son of Beor, they also killed with the sword. So Balaam, although we're told he had gone back to his place in chapter 24, at the end of the chapter, his place was actually up in Mesopotamia. He hadn't gone back there. He apparently had gone back to his lodgings in the area because Balak, the king of Moab, had hired him to come down from Mesopotamia, 360 miles from his home, to curse the people of Israel. Apparently, Balaam had not really gone home yet. He had done what he was going to do. And one of the things he was going to do, and we know this because we're going to be told that in verse 16, is that he counseled Balak to bring about this incident, to send these women in to seduce the men of Israel so that God would curse them. Balaam was, everything we read about him in chapters 22 through 24 made him seem like a fairly decent guy. But he deserved to die because he was the mastermind behind the apostasy and the orgy and so forth that the Moabites and the Midianites had brought on Israel. So he was killed. Sadly, in one of his oracles, he said, "Oh, that I might die the death of the righteous." Well, if you want to die the death of the righteous, you have to live the life of a righteous person. And he didn't. He loved the wages of unrighteousness, the New Testament tells us, and therefore he did not die the death of the righteous. That statement where he said, "Oh, that I might die the death of the righteous," was in chapter 23 and verse 10. But Balaam died the death of the wicked man. Now, in that same verse, five kings of Midian are said to have died. One of them is Zur. He was the father of Cozbi, the woman involved in the incident with the javelin. His daughter was the one who was leading Zimri and the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Simeon, into this cult prostitution in the tabernacle. Her dad, Zur, is here named as one of the kings of Midian, although these same five men who are named here are also named in Joshua 13:21, and there they are referred to as princes of Sihon. Now, Sihon was the Amorite king of the area who had been defeated by Israel in an earlier chapter here. Sihon was no longer around, but these men had been princes of his. Whether that means they were simply princes that served under his suzerainty-ship, or whether they were actually his sons of Sihon. They could be, princes of his that he assigned to positions over the Midianites when he conquered Midian. It's hard to say. But since Cozbi is said to be a Midianite woman rather than an Amorite woman, her father was probably Midianite, not Amorite, probably these five kings were leaders of the Midianite people who had been given positions by Sihon when he was their overlord of the region. He was now gone. Now they're gone. Verse 9, and the children of Israel took all the women of Midian captive and their little ones, and took as a spoil all their cattle, all their flocks, all their goods. They also burned with fire all the cities where they dwelt and all their forts. And they took all the spoil and all the booty, both of man and beast. Of man and beast would include slaves, of course. Booty of man and beast would mean, they took the women and the children, and they took whatever slaves there were. Probably only the female slaves, though, since we're told they killed all the males. So man would simply mean human. Really, it's women and children. Then they brought the captives, the booty, the spoil, to Moses and Eleazar the priest, and to the congregation of the children of Israel by the camp, or to the camp in the plains of Moab, by Jordan across from Jericho. And Moses, Eleazar the priest, and all the leaders of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. And Moses was angry with the officers of the army, with the captains over thousands and captains over hundreds who had come from the battle. And Moses said to them, have you kept all the women alive? Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against Yahweh in the incident of Peor. And there was a plague among the congregation of Yahweh. Now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately. But keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately. Now, this is the part that's hardest for us as modern Christians, or even simply modern products of Western civilization, to have any sympathy for. Killing the little ones, including little boys. In fact, it was just the little boys. The little girls were virgins and they were kept alive. Now, a lot of people represent this as, oh, they kept these women alive as sex slaves. That's a rather jaded view of things. I suppose those who think that are people who would do that themselves. We usually attribute to the Israelites motives that perhaps we think we would have. I don't assume that they were keeping them alive as sex slaves. They were just keeping them alive as slaves. They were not a threat to Israel because they were female, and females were not warriors. They were not guilty of what had happened at Baal Peor because they were virgins. The guilty women were the ones who had gone out and slept with the men and seduced them. So, now the young boys, you might say, well, they're innocent too. At the moment, for Israel to keep 30,000 little boys of Midian in their ranks, whose parents are all dead. What? Was Israel supposed to become a Midianite orphanage? That's not what God had in mind for Israel. Israel was to be a nation separate from the other nations. God didn't raise Israel up to be an orphanage for Midianite boys. These boys' parents were dead, and they themselves would grow up to be Midianite men if they grew up under the roofs of the Israelites as Midianites, that'd be a force of the enemy growing up right in their camp. That was something that Moses felt needed to be prevented. So these boys had to go with their parents. And only the girls were allowed to survive because they were not a threat militarily. And, of course, did some of them end up being concubines and wives to the Israelites? Probably. Probably some of them did. But it's not to be assumed that it says you keep them for yourselves. There's such a jaded, oversexed culture we live in that people think, oh, they kept these little girls to be their sex slaves. Well, if God had allowed people to have sex slaves like that and to sleep with little girls, and if these people were as corrupt as modern people are who read the passage and think that, then maybe that's what they did. But it doesn't say so. It doesn't say keep them for sex slaves. It just says keep them alive. Don't kill them. Keep them for yourselves. Well, they would be raised to be cooks and house cleaners and slave girls. And perhaps some of them, if they pleased their masters in that way, might have become wives to them or concubines. There were wives and concubines in Israel, and that's possible that some of these girls became that. But he's not saying just keep them to have around as sex slaves. Even a concubine was not a sex slave per se. A concubine, although she was a slave and a sex partner to her master, she was a wife. A concubine was a species of wife. There were two kinds of wives, free and slave wives. But as wives, they raised children. They had children and raised children for their husbands. And as we see in the case of Jacob's family, he's got Rachel and Leah are free women. And Bilhah and Zilpah are concubines, slave wives. They all had children. All of them were part of one big family. We don't relate well with slavery at all in our society, but the truth of the matter is a slave wife was not the same thing as a sex slave. A slave wife was really a wife and a mother to children in the family and was treated like such. She just wasn't given complete freedom for whatever reasons. Perhaps because the free wives didn't want the concubines to have the same status as them or something. I don't know. The culture was very different than ours. But certainly, this is not just saying, keep the little girls and have sex with them. And yet, almost everybody who criticizes this chapter, including Christians I've heard criticize it, seem to assume the worst. And I assume that that's telling me something about the mentality of the person making the criticism. Because they assume, well, if I was there, I guess I'd do that to them. I mean, if you're not thinking that, why would you suspect that the Israelites would have that? Obviously, we do project our own sins to the minds of other people. This was an almost total annihilation of Midianite population, with only the exception that the innocent young girls were not killed. They were kept to be servants rather than casualties. That was something God didn't even allow in the case of the Canaanites. They weren't supposed to leave any alive of the Canaanites, but God showed mercy on the young and innocent girls in this case. Verse 19, as for you, he says to the soldiers, remain outside the camp 7 days. Whoever has killed any person and whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves and your captives on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. Now, that's the normal procedure for anyone who touched a dead body. We've seen that earlier. You're unclean for 7 days. On the 3rd day, you get sprinkled with this water that has the ashes of red heifer in it. And then on the 7th day, same thing. And then you're done being unclean. That was just the results of being in touch with dead bodies. All of these people who had killed somebody or touched a dead body had to go through the regular ritual. Purify every garment, everything made of leather, every woven thing of goat's hair, everything made of wood. That would be the booty they brought back, all the wealth and all the stuff. Then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to the battle, this is the ordinance of the law which Yahweh commanded Moses. Only the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that can endure fire, you shall put through fire, and it shall be clean, and it shall be purified with the water of purification. But all that cannot endure fire, you shall put through water. And you shall wash your clothes on the seventh day and be clean, and afterward you may come into the camp. So everything they brought back from Midian has got to be considered to be unclean, because it was an unclean people. Everything is defiled, but it can be cleansed. If it's something that is non-perishable, metals, they can be purified through fire, probably melted down in all likelihood. And then everything that, of course, would burn up in fire would be cleansed otherwise by washing in water. Verse 25, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, count up the plunder that was taken, both of man and beast, you and Eleazar the priest and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts between those who took part in the war, who went out to battle, and all the congregation. So there were 12,000 that went to battle, and then there were like almost 600,000 others who didn't. But half the plunder was given to the 12,000 men because they actually participated in the war. The other half was given to be distributed among the other half million or more Israelites. Obviously, the Israelites who didn't go to battle received much less reward, but then they had not taken the risks either. And levy a tribute for the Lord on the men of war who went out to battle, one of every 500 of the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, and the sheep. Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as the heave offering to the Lord. And from the children of Israel half, you should take one of every 50, drawn from the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, and the sheep, from all the livestock, and give them to the Levites, who keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord. So the booty was to be consecrated to the Lord by giving a portion of it to the priests and a portion to the Levites. The portion that was given to the priests was taken from the warriors' half, and the portion given to the Levites was taken from the half that was given to the congregation. The warriors were supposed to give one out of every 500 of specimens that were brought as booty to the priests. And the children of Israel were to give one of every 50 of theirs to the Levites. So Moses and Eleazar, the priests, did as the Lord commanded Moses. And the booty remaining from the plunder, which the men of war had taken, was 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all of women who had not known a man intimately. So, as I say, 32,000 virgin women. It's all, in all likelihood, the number of women who were not virgins outnumbered them, and then there were the men. So you're going to have, I would say, at least 120,000 Midianites, if not more, that Israel went out against with 12,000 men, which is, if that estimate is accurate, that's approximately 10-to-1 odds against them. And yet we will find not one Israelite was killed. We find that out in verse 49. But in verse 36, it says, and the half, the portion of those who had gone out to war, was in number 337,500 sheep. The Lord's tribute of the sheep was 675. The cattle were 36,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 72. The donkeys were 30,500, of which the Lord's tribute was 61. The persons were 16,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 32. Now, the 16,000 apparently is in addition to the 32,000, so we really have a bigger number than I was figuring. We're looking at more like 48,000 virgin women, because the 32,000 were those that came from one half that was given, and this is the there were 16,000 that was came from the other half of the booty. So Moses gave the tribute, which was the Lord's heave offering, to Eleazar the priest, and the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses. And from the children of Israel's half, which Moses separated from men who fought, now the half belonged to the congregation, was 337,500 sheep. And if you're interested, you can read the rest of the numbers. Verse 48. Then the officers who were over thousands of the army, the captains of thousands, the captains of hundreds, came near to Moses. And they said to Moses, your servants have taken account of the men of war who were under our command, and not a man is missing. Not one of our people was killed. Therefore, we have brought an offering to Yahweh. What every man found of ornaments of gold, armlets and bracelets and signet rings and earrings and necklaces, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. This, of course, was the jewelry of those who were slain of the Midianites. So Moses and Eleazar, the priests, received the gold from them, all the fashioned ornaments, and all the gold of the offering that they offered to the Lord from the captains of the thousands and captains of hundreds. It was 16,750 shekels, which is something like 450 pounds or something like that. I mean, that's a lot of weight of gold. Now, if you've ever seen what an ounce of gold looks like, an ounce is, you know, when you hold a gold coin that's an ounce, it's heavier than it looks, because gold is denser than most every other metal that we ever handle. And it's heavy for its size. And that's only an ounce. These days, an ounce of gold is worth, what, $1,200, something in that neighborhood right now? Unless it's gone down since last time I looked. 1 ounce, over $1,000. 16 ounces to the pound, 400 and something pounds of gold. There's a lot of wealth here that they've pulled in, and these guys are giving it to the Lord, which means giving it to the tabernacle for its maintenance. Verse 53, the men of war had taken spoil, every man for himself, and Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from the captains of thousands and hundreds and brought it into the tabernacle of meeting as a memorial to the children of Israel before the Lord. All right, now we have in chapter 32, two tribes initially joined eventually by a third, a half of a third tribe, have decided they liked this territory on the east side of the Jordan. Now, where these people were right now was on the plains of Moab on the eastern shore of the Jordan. They were not in the promised land. They were not in Canaan. They had not crossed over yet. They would do that with Joshua after Moses was to die. At this point, they were just looking across the river at the promised land. And the only reason they acquired property on the east side was not because they wanted it or God had promised it to them, but because the people there had attacked them. Sion and Og had attacked them. And so in self-defense, Israel had fought Sion and Og and conquered them and took their territory. So all of a sudden, and now with the Midianites also out of the way, you've got all this territory, all this what we call the Eastern Tableland on the other side of Jordan from Israel. It's all under Jewish control now. It's all under Israel's control. Now, it's good pasture land. And Reuben and Gad were two of the tribes that for whatever reason had more livestock than the others. We don't know why they had more livestock than the other tribes. Or maybe they just valued their livestock more and wanted to go into ranching where the other tribes were interested in going into other pursuits after they went into the promised land. But these two tribes, and later half of the tribe of Manasseh, decide that this pasture land on the east side of Jordan is really quite desirable for people like them who had a lot of livestock. Great grazing land. And so they're going to come to Moses with a request that this can be their inheritance. And the thought does not appeal to Moses initially, but then they negotiate something that is acceptable to Moses, as we shall see. Now, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of livestock. And when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, which is where they were, that indeed the region was a place for livestock, the children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spoke to Moses, to Eleazar the priest, and to the leaders of the congregation, saying, Ataroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Elealeh, Shebam, Nebo, and Baon. The country which the Lord defeated before the congregation of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. Therefore, they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession, and do not take us over the Jordan. Now, what they're saying essentially is, this land is good enough. The land that God has offered us, we're not that interested in. They were judging, of course, entirely by the sight of their eyes, very much like what Lot had done when Lot was given the choice of what portion of the land to take his flocks on. And Abram said, you go to the right, I'll go to the left, or you go to the left, I'll go to the right. You just take your pick. It says that Lot beheld that the plains of the Jordan were as lush as the garden of the Lord, and so he chose that land. Ended up being a bad choice for Lot because, of course, his choice included the region where Sodom and Gomorrah were, and he got sucked right in to that culture and lost his family and almost lost his life as a result of that. And so I believe the Reubenites and the Gadites, and eventually half the tribe of the Manassites who joined them here, I think they're making a bad choice. It was, in some senses, a choice that might be seen as an insult to God. God said, I've got some land for you people. They say, well, no, we're not interested in that land. We all want this land. There's a sense in which this resembled, at least Moses thought this resembled, the rebellion at Kadesh Barnea, where the spies had come back and said, the land that we saw, you know, it's a great land for sure, but we can't conquer it. And by implication, saying, we're better off here. And they rejected the land of Canaan because although they weren't saying the wilderness was a great place to be, they were saying Canaan was a worse place to be. And by implication, this is the same principle. They're saying, this place we're at now, we like this better than what God has promised us on the other side of the Jordan. And Moses saw this as something drawing dangerously close to the same mistake that the people had made when they refused to go into the land at the report of the spies 40 years earlier than this, 38 years earlier. And Moses said, verse 6, to the children of Gad and the children of Reuben, shall your brethren go to war while you sit here? Now why will you be discouraging the hearts of the children of Israel from going over into the land which the Lord has given them? Thus your fathers did when I sent them away from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the children of Israel, so that they did not go into the land which the Lord had given them. So the Lord's anger was aroused on that day, and he swore an oath, saying, surely none of the men who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and above shall see the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. So the Lord's anger was aroused against Israel, Moses continues, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years, until all that generation had that had done evil in his sight was gone. And look, you have risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. For you turn away from following him. For if you turn away from following him, he will once again leave them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all these people. So Moses sees them as saying, you know, we're not interested in the promised land, we're interested in this land. That's not much different than what the spies said, saying, you know, we're not interested in taking the promised land either. If you get these people starting to think, yeah, this land over here, the land of the Amorites, this is actually good enough for us. Why go fight the Canaanites over that land over there? You're going to discourage the people from doing what God wants them to do. But the Reubenites and the Gadites had a counter offer. In verse 16, then they came near to him and said, we will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones. But we ourselves will be armed, ready to go before the children of Israel, until we have brought them into their place. And our little ones will dwell in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until every one of the children of Israel has received his inheritance. For we will not inherit them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on the eastern side of the Jordan. So they're making this proposal. We're not refusing to go and endanger ourselves with the rest of our brethren in the wars of Canaan. We'll go. We'll go ahead of the rest of them. We don't mind, you know, doing our share of the fighting for the country. But when it's all over and when the land has been secured and when parcels are being given out to the tribes, we would like to come back to this side and have this be our parcel. In fact, we'll build our livestock shelters and so forth here right now. We'll put our children up in the fortified cities with our wives, and we'll, just the men of us, will go with you and fight the battles until we're done, and then we'll come back over here. Now, that sounded fairly reasonable to Moses, as it turns out. Moses said to them, if you do this thing, if you arm yourselves before the Lord for war, and all your armed men cross over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, Then afterward you may return and be blameless before the Lord and before Israel. And this land shall be your possession before the Lord. But if you do not do so, then take note, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. That's where that famous expression comes from. Build cities for your little ones, and folds for your sheep, and do what has proceeded out of your mouth. And the children of Gad and the children of Reuben spoke to Moses, saying, your servants will do as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, our flocks, and all our livestock will be there in the cities of Gilead. But your servants will cross over, every man armed for war, before the Lord to battle, just as my Lord says. Now, in a sense, they're saying we're taking the same risks that all of our brethren are taking, and therefore we're not really getting, you know, a better deal than others here. But they are getting one thing better deal. One is that they're not taking their children over into Canaan where the wars are going to be. Their children are going to be left in a safer place, whereas the other tribes are taking their whole families over into the war zone. So, but on the other hand, their families will be left over here on the east side of Jordan without their men to protect them. So presumably there'd be other kinds of dangers for a community of women and children left without men. Perhaps the old men, too old to fight in war, would stay with them, but this would not be an exactly equal situation for them, but close enough. Now, this choice of the Reubenites and the Gadites to do this ended up being a really bad decision for them. They were left in a part of the land that didn't have natural defenses. Canaan did. The land that God gave Israel had natural defenses. They had the River Jordan on the right, the eastern border. They had the Mediterranean on the western border. And they had narrow passageways to the north and the south where people could invade, but which could more easily be defended. But over on the side of Jordan where these people were, the defenses were, invaders could come from any area and it just overwhelm you. And that did happen. The people of Reuben eventually were diminished to almost nothing. And the people of Gad and Manasseh on that side of the river also became overrun and corrupted. These were the people who were over on the far side of Jordan 1,400 years later in the time of Jesus. These were the descendants of these people, the Reubenites and the Gadites, were the ones in Transjordan where Jesus went over and he cast the demon out of the man of the tombs, and the people, the Jewish people there, asked Jesus to leave the area. They were not spiritual people. They were people who were concerned only about their livestock. And remember, on that incident, they had pigs for livestock. That was a compromise for Jews too. And they asked Jesus to leave because their livestock got killed by the demons driving them into the sea. The Reubenites and Gadites were people who were mainly motivated by their economics, by their business, their livestock business. And they were not really very loyal to the Lord. They didn't realize that if God had promised them a land across the Jordan, then if God is good, then the land across the Jordan would be a better place for them to be. Instead, they went by the side of their eyes and made a choice that was just ended up being as poor a choice for them as Lot's choice was when he made a similar kind of choice on the same basis. Verse 28, so Moses gave command concerning them to Eleazar, the priest, to Joshua the son of Nun, and to the chief fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel. Moses said to them, if the children of Gad and the children of Reuben cross over Jordan with you, every man armed for battle before the Lord, and the land is subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead as a possession. If they do not cross over armed with you, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. Then the children of Gad and the children of Reuben answered, saying, as Yahweh has said to your servants, so we will do. Now, we don't read that Moses got instructions from Yahweh about this. On cases like when the man was found gathering sticks and they had to decide what to do with him on the Sabbath, or the man who blasphemed the Lord, it says the man was put in custody while Moses went and consulted the Lord about it and got a word from the Lord about it. Generally speaking, Moses would go off and ask God about things. We don't read that Moses asked God about this. It seems like Moses was simply convinced by the Reubenites and the Gadites to go along with it because they were making what sounded like perhaps a reasonable request in the end. However, the Reubenites and the Gadites say this is what the Lord has said in verse 31, so maybe we should understand it that way. Maybe Moses had consulted the Lord, or maybe they were just assuming it. In any case, it was not a good choice for them. Verse 32, we will cross over armed before the Lord into the land of Canaan, but the possession of our inheritance shall remain with us on this side of the Jordan. So Moses gave to the children of Gad, to the children of Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. This is the first time they're mentioned in this coalition, but apparently half of the Manassites, not all of them, they wanted to do the same thing. So they were permitted to do this also. Gave the kingdom of Sion, the king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, the king of Bashan, the land with its cities, with its borders, the cities of the surrounding country. And the children of Gad built Dibon and Ataroth and Aroer, Atroth and Shophan and Jazer and Jogbeha, Beth Nimrah and Beth Haran, fortified cities and folds for sheep. And the children of Reuben built Heshbon and Eleah and Kirjathaim, Nebo and Baal Meon, their names being changed, because Nebo and Baal Meon both had the names of pagan gods in the name of those cities, so their names were changed. And Shibma. And they gave other names to the cities which they built. Now, these cities they built, it's not likely they built these entire cities while they were waiting to go into Canaan. This was only, they were only parked there on the plains of Moab for who knows how long, only months at the longest. Weeks, probably. And it's not likely they built all these cities within those few days before going across the Jordan. But rather, it's probable these were already cities that had existed but were now emptied by the conquests. And they did build them in the sense that they perhaps modified them for their habitation and gave them new names. For example, they built sheepfolds and things like that. But it's not likely they built these cities just from the ground up at this point, unless it's referring to something they did later, after the conquest and they came back. Verse 39, and the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and took it and dispossessed the Amorites who were in it. So Moses gave Gilead to Machir, the son of Manasseh, and he dwelt in it. Also, Jair, the son of Manasseh, went and took its small towns and called them Havoth Jair. Havoth Jair means towns of Jair. Then Nobah went and took Kenath and its villages, and he called it Nobah after himself. Now, this is where we'll have to take our break. These references to Jair, the son of Manasseh, and Machir, the son of Manasseh, refers to certain branches of the Manassite tribe, and they are apparently given because they are the part of the Manassite tribe that stayed there on the eastern border. The rest of the tribe of Manasseh did not. They went in and received an inheritance with the rest of Israel in Canaan. But this explains how it is that these 2.5 tribes ended up on the other side of the Jordan. And so, although it was not land that God had promised to Israel, it was land that became part of Israel's possession, at least temporarily, until these people were eventually conquered by foreigners. Okay, we're going to take a break then.